God.
Well, that makes it sound very official.
Does. And go ahead, Frank. Why don't you introduce our presenter?
Okay. Well, welcome, everyone. We're so happy you're here today. So we are honored to have Mike Steele join us. Mike Steele is a professor of mathematics education at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a program officer in the Division of Research on Learning at the National Science Foundation. He currently serves as president of the Association of Mathematics Teacher Education. His research interests include the development of mathematical knowledge for teaching and the development of effective teaching practices that support rich student learning. Welcome, Mike. Now, for those for everyone who's come in a little bit later, Mike is really interested in your questions during the session. So please feel free to ask questions as I'm looking through the chat at times when there I hear Mike pause, I will forward your questions to him. Or also, Mike wants to would love to have this session interactive.
Great. Thanks, Frank. And thanks to Amatic for having me here as a part of our presidential exchange program. I'm going to share what you will see as my blank screen and then get to projecting. And Frank, you'll have to let me know if you're seeing things as they should be there.
It looks like we see you and we also see your presentation up. So everything looks good.
Fabulous. And I'm just orienting my chat window so I can see that. And Frank, I notoriously barely take a breath to pause, so don't necessarily wait until a pause in the cadence. If you see something, just go ahead and talk over me and fire it in there.
Got it. Okay.
One of those things, not teaching in-person classes right now, like I almost miss students just going ahead and talking over what I have to say. So it'll be very refreshing. Thanks to all of you for spending close to an hour of your day with me today. I want to talk a little bit about kind of what I see as new research and practice frontiers in the two-year college landscape, but really not limiting it to two-year colleges. So in my role as president of the Association of Mathematics Teacher Educators, the teacher education, teacher preparation pipeline is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And thinking about how we're moving students into that work of teacher preparation. What I'm going to talk about today even extends beyond that, just thinking about primarily across that K-12 secondary mathematics to the first 2 years of college, whether it be at a two-year or four-year institution to a four-year institution, how we're thinking about the research, the practice that we engage in the context of mathematics. So I'll talk a little bit about kind of this idea of research practice partnerships. It's something that I know some of you, at least from the names I saw popping on here today, you've probably got a little bit of familiarity with. There are some folks that this may be a little bit new to you. This idea of a research practice partnership, the name isn't new, but I think we're seeing some renewed energy and investment around these partnerships. And I'm going to make some arguments about why I think this is particularly important at this moment in time in which we find ourselves here in 2020. I'm going to then highlight, once we talk a little bit about kind of how you might structure and put together a research practice partnership, what I see as some of the areas of critical need right now in mathematics education for us to focus this sort of work. I'm going to share a couple of examples from the field. If you heard my talk last year, one of these is going to be familiar to you, although I've got some new and updated content on it, how we're working on a research practice partnership in Milwaukee between Milwaukee Public Schools, the Milwaukee Area Technical College, which is our absolute beast of a two-year institution in Milwaukee, and then the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, my home institution. And I'll share a second example, actually, from not far from where we're supposed to be right now in Eastern Washington. And I also want to hear about aspects of research practice partnerships that either you all have engaged in your work, or that you'd be interested in creating some inquiry. Maybe actually through this session, we can do a little bit of informal networking on that as we hear what people are interested in engaging in across context. And then got a little bit of a call to action for you for things that you can do that I'd love to see us all think about collectively working on in small groups as we go forward. So with that, let me dive in a little bit into thinking about kind of what do we mean by research practice partnerships? How do they come about? What are the things that we need to pay attention to? And I want to start with this. Why is this important right now? Why, you know, I could have spent 45 minutes talking about just about anything I wanted to talk about here. Why is this the thing that I thought was critical for us to focus on in the time that we have together today? I think one of the things that we see right now in mathematics teaching and learning is the need for a much stronger articulation, both of content and of pedagogy across what I'm kind of broadly referring to is that 6 to 16 spectrum. So middle school, high school, and you know, the first 4 years of tertiary instruction in whatever institution or institutions that tends to occur in. So we've been really pressing on this work. If you've been a part of the work that the Dana Center at the University of Texas at Austin has been working on and thinking about mathematics pathways and how we're thinking about developmental mathematics and kind of who gets access to those developmental courses, how students place into those, where they go beyond that, this articulation, getting a stronger and more coherent articulation of moving students across those boundaries is really critically important. I'll give a little shout out to my colleagues, Keith Nabb, and Jackie Makarska, who helped me put a little article together that we put in the AMTE Connections newsletter that talked about the importance of looking at these transitional points, these junctures as people move from, our students move from one of these systems to another. And so I think also we've seen this rise in students and faculty that cross over between these institutions. So some examples I have here, the push right now, which is exceedingly strong in some places, to award high school students collegiate credit while they're still in that high school process. And regardless of where we fall on what the wisdom of this work is and the scope of it, the genie's not going back in the bottle on this, right? So this idea of aggregating some college credits for students while they're in high school is something that's going to continue to happen. So we really have to be thoughtful about where those intersection points are and how we articulate those ideas. The rise in transfer and reverse transfer agreements that we see between institutions. In Milwaukee, we are increasingly trying to think about how do we really grease the skids for students to come from the 2-year to the 4-year institution? How are we thinking about getting them through those first 2 years, even if they haven't checked all the boxes for an associate's degree, and then having them move to the 4-year institution and reverse transferring credits back and awarding that 2-year degree while they work towards the 4-year. So we've all got to be really on the same page about this. And then a problem problem/ opportunity, right? That I think we're going to continue to see rise as university budgets are constrained is that we've got more adjunct faculty members, many that are working across institutions. I have colleagues who teach in the math in both my math department at UWM and in the math department at MATC at our 2-year college. And actually, in the University of Wisconsin system, we've recently absorbed the two-year colleges in our system under our UWM banner. So thinking about this articulation as we have faculty members that are crossing over, and I'll even point out with these college and high school credit-bearing programs that we have in many places, we need to be certifying our high school teachers with the same set of review credentials that we use at the college so they can teach these college-bearing courses. So all this really says we've got to get on the same page with this work. And then the question that I have right here in red, I think, is really the $64,000 question, particularly with the rise of of alternative pathways. When I think about, in particular, teacher certification that's going on right now, the micro credentialing movement that's occurring both within our institutions and outside of higher education, the question I keep coming back to is that we need to be thinking about how do we justify that the work we do with students is making a difference. As the economy tightens during the pandemic, as students have to make difficult choices about are they going to re-enroll in courses in our institutions, I think this question is one that needs to be increasingly present in our mind. Like, how do we justify that what we bring is valuable, is important, and makes a difference? And these research practice partnerships, particularly as we collaborate across institutions, are critically important. So I tried to highlight with this graphic, couldn't resist a little geometry in here, thinking about what are the key facets of a research practice partnership. And there are a number of them. There are probably more than the five I've just highlighted here, but I want to frame what we talk about by mentioning at least four of the five right now, and funding off to the right there. I'm going to get to kind of a little bit on the back end as we go. So a research practice partnership, you've got to have kind of a joint research agenda. What are we going to look at? What are we going to inquire about that's common across our contexts? We need a diverse set of stakeholders, and I'll talk a little bit about how we find those people, how we bring those people together in a few moments. Evaluation, like how do we know that we're making progress on the work, and data sharing, which I'd argue of those things is probably the least sexy of those five topics to talk about, but I'll make an argument that it's really an important thing for us to think about. And again, coming back to the funding question, like even if we've got interest and we've got people who are really willing to drive some of these research practice partnerships, how do we support them in ways that get the work off the ground and then sustain the work going forward? So let me start with this idea of a joint research agenda, just coming together. And I want to emphasize that this doesn't have to be fancy or elaborate. It can just really be at the level of saying to ourselves, like, how are we thinking about, for example, how algebraic ideas that are key prerequisites for kids going into a calculus sequence, how do they play out among some courses, and what are we doing to really foster students' engagement with those algebraic ideas like rate of change, like equivalence? It could be certainly broader than that. The M-Cubed partnership out of Milwaukee that I'll touch on in a little bit has an incredibly ambitious research agenda that really looks at strengthening the outcomes for students across those institutions and not just in mathematics. But these really, for a successful research or practice agenda, they have to focus on real world priorities. And I look at this idea of developing that joint research agenda as really evolving and bubbling up from practice. This should be driven by problems of practice that we're seeing in our institution. So for example, one of the things that keeps me up at night in thinking about, these sorts of problems of practice is how are we positioning our students to be good civic quantitative reasoners? Like in thinking about the mathematics that played out across the election cycle that we're in the process of finishing up finally, there was so much really interesting mathematics that came about during the pandemic. There's been so much interesting and critical to understand mathematics that's coming about, and certainly some areas in which people are grossly misinterpreting or misreading quantitative data in ways that if they were reading it well, would actually really help our societal response. Thinking about the pandemic, the kind of the second pandemic related to racial injustice, like understanding that has a lot of quantitative reasoning related to it. So there are all these really interesting questions, and it can be something that's kind of that simple and straightforward. Like, how do we position students in secondary and tertiary mathematics to be better quantitative reasoners? So really focusing on those real world priorities. And then the next piece of this really is thinking about multiple levels of inquiry for a good research practice partnership that sustains and evolves over time. Having those multiple levels of inquiry are important. So if I think about quantitative reasoning that I take as an example here, I might think about, okay, what do we notice that's going on in each of those levels? What are our existing practices in each of those courses? How do our standards in each of those places play into that? How do things like our collegiate requirements, I'll talk a little bit as we go on about the work we've done at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, looking at what's our first credit-bearing college mathematics course and how are the different majors we have positioning mathematics in the context of those majors. Like, that's an issue that relates to quantitative reasoning. And then even what's the career embedded aspect of that? What do our journalism majors really need to know and understand about quantitative reasoning? What do our nursing majors need to really know and understand about quantitative reasoning? What do our welding certificate seekers need to understand about quantitative reasoning? And then one of the things that I really like to focus on is you're starting to develop a joint research agenda that helps with this idea of being multi-layered is, you know, thinking about these multiple levels of inquiry, the different places along that continuum that we're going to look and that we're going to think about, always having kind of this key question in mind, because it's easy to get bogged down in those multiple levels. It's easy to get in the weeds with the research or working on the professional development and lose sight of the big picture. So being able to kind of keep in front of us, what's the one thing that if we learn about this, we'll consider the work successful at some level? I think it's a really important part for keeping that research agenda grounded. So it's a little bit about how I think about developing a research agenda. Bringing together diverse stakeholders is really important for this work. And again, when I think about work across that 6 to 16 spectrum, I think about, you know, middle school, high school teachers of mathematics. I think about our college and university faculty being a part of that. But depending on the question, I might think about community members that need to be a part of that. I may think about people from business and industry, depending on the question I have, that really want to be a part of that. So I think thinking about the research practice partnership, that research to practice, those aren't two poles. They're not two kind of categorical ideas, research and practice. It's a continuum across them. I like to think of my work as practice-informed research and conducting research that then would in turn, you know, affect the practice of the high school teachers, for example, with which I work, that the practice would be a little bit more upfront for them, but backed by that research. So always thinking about when you're getting started and pulling stakeholders together, where's our work going to be across this research to practice spectrum? And all of your stakeholders are going to have a little bit of a different answer to this question. Like, for me, my strength is in designing and enacting that research and thinking about what's a good question for us to look at. Where are we going to look for the data to answer those questions? And then I want people who are in different places in that spectrum who are going to push me to make sure what's that, those research outcomes are actionable, that they're useful, that they drive changes in practice. Because we could do all the research in the world, if it doesn't drive changes in how we're teaching and learning mathematics, I question why we're even doing it and why it's useful. And when I think about who are the people I want to bring together, I kind of use this framing of the four A's that have to be involved here. That we have to think about access, acumen, availability, and attitude. Access is thinking about where are the places that I'm going to want and need to look, and who has access to those spaces and the information in those spaces.
And have a question.
Yep.
So Anne has the question, should agenda be developed prior to inviting stakeholders to the partnership, or should the stakeholders contribute to developing the agenda?
Yes. So I think you should have a set of broad goals in mind as you start inviting stakeholders to the table. So there's this issue, there's this conundrum, there's this situation in our community that we want to take a look at, that we want to dig into. And so it may not be a fully framed out research agenda before inviting stakeholders to the table. But if you do have a fully framed out research agenda and you're inviting stakeholders and they say, well, but you know, I think we really should go slightly in this direction, then you end up in this awkward position of making them feel like they're changing the game that you've invited everybody to come and play in. Developing that research agenda really needs to be collaborative and evolutionary. That there should be opportunities for people to share their thoughts about this, to push the research in new and different directions, to evolve it as we go. So I think having a broad sense of what that research agenda is up front is important because it helps people understand what they're signing on to do. But then making sure that we have some explicit attention as we get those groups together for the first few times and get them started to saying, all right, how do we want to shape this? What do we want the specific aspects of inquiry here to be? And I think that relates to kind of this first A in here, Anne, which is this idea of access. Like I need to think about where am I going to need access to data, to classrooms, to perspectives, and who are the people that have the access to do that? Acumen really speaks to the skills that my stakeholders bring to the table. Like, for example, my work in terms of research expertise really is focused on teacher knowledge. I do some mixed methods work, but qualitative research is really my bread and butter. So if I'm thinking about a large scale quantitative analysis, I want somebody who's got that acumen, who's got my back on the quantitative analysis side. If I'm thinking about how we support students with special needs in moving through our 6 to 16 spectrum, again, math education, my area of expertise, special ed, less so. So I need somebody who's got that acumen, who brings that to the table. Availability kind of sounds like a no-brainer. Like this, oftentimes when we're getting started and talking about we have a big, rich, complex, interesting problem that we want to try to solve, people get really excited about that. And I know, and I speak from personal experience as someone who tends to overcommit to stuff, that sometimes my enthusiasm outpaces my actual hours and minutes availability to get the work done. So you want to make sure you're upfront about the commitment that you're asking people to make, and that you invite them to be open and honest about what they can bring to the table in terms of availability. And then finally, that fourth A there, attitude, super important. You want people who are really going to take a collaborative approach to the work. I know oftentimes I fall into this trap of there's this, particularly if I'm the one who's organizing a research practice partnership like this, I've got a vision of what it's going to be in my head. It's well articulated. But if I am too committed to that vision unflinchingly and unfailingly, my attitude about that is going to get in the way, because I need to be open to people shaping and helping me change and co-evolve that work. If you have people who just get an idea and are interested and invested in it, and they're locked in on that, and they're not willing to deviate from that plan, you're going to have a little bit of a bumpy ride with your research to practice partnership. So a couple of other small things that I think about when I think about these stakeholders is that sometimes a small and really well-committed team may be better than a large and more diverse in terms of roles, but scattered in terms of effort, at least starting out with a small committed team and thinking about how do I bring some people on, recruit some additional folks. That relates to that third bullet there, setting up regular opportunities to kind of reevaluate where we're at, what the expertise is we need, and to recruit additional folks. I think being flexible with that recruitment and bringing people in as they go. And there are ultimately also going to be situations where people are going to have things that pull them in different directions, or they're going to go to a different place or different context, and kind of wander away from that partnership. And just taking that as a critical starting point is really important. And then differentiating roles that allow for flexible movement. So for example, when I set up a research practice partnership that was really had an aspect of teacher professional development and some, you know, teacher pipeline and career development as a part of it, and had a research agenda to it. I initially set up kind of, here's kind of our research team, here's our professional development design team, here's our evaluation team that keeps us on track and you know, make sure we're asking the right questions. And people then started to move flexibly among those roles as we went, but differentiating those roles up front was really important because it gave a sense that we don't all have to do every aspect of this together and with the same kind of level of commitment and expertise. It gave people permission to kind of lean into their strengths. The last two facets I want to talk about, and I promise I'll talk about the funding issue as we go later on, are the two I noted on evaluation and data sharing. Putting on my National Science Foundation hat for just a moment, the projects that I find are most effective in achieving their goals in contexts like a research practice partnership are ones that pay attention to this issue of evaluation right from the start. There's always this set of questions we need to ask ourselves: how are we defining success, and who's responsible for helping us understand if we're making progress? So having some people who stand at the periphery of your research practice partnership, and they should have a fluency with what they're doing. It's okay if they're embedded in it, but really having people who you say, I want your primary roles to be our critical friends, that you are coming in and asking us the hard questions about, are we answering the questions we set out to ask? Are we on track for what we want to do? Research practice partnerships are dense and messy because we're dealing with ideas of mathematics, teaching, and learning. And we all know there's a lot that goes into that work. And there are things that can pull us in different directions and take us into different places and spaces than what we initially thought, you know, we would do. So having that evaluative team to say, you know, what are you doing right now? Why are you doing it? How is it helping you meet the goals of that partnership? And maybe that means that there are spots in that research practice partnership where we need to step out and redefine what we mean as success or reorient our goals. But that is a normal and healthy part of a good research practice partnership. The last thing I just want to mention here is data sharing. And I see this mentioned when I read stuff about research practice partnerships. And I know initially when I'd set up a few, like, I'm like, oh, well, you know, we're going to collect some data. And of course, everybody will have access to it and that sort of thing. But this is a place where you can really get derailed in a research practice partnership. And having this discussion up front, I think, is really important. So what data will we be collecting? Who's going to have access to it? By what means, for how long, particularly if people fade in and out of roles on your research practice partnership, it's really important to think about, are they going to continue to have access to the people, to the data, to one another as researchers? If people want to write about this, if people want to tell the story of what you're doing, who are we giving the ability to do that? And again, this is a place where feelings can get hurt really, really quickly. So I think thinking about having those conversations up front and as roles change, saying, all right, how are we going to reevaluate access to data? And then, you know, particularly when we're dealing with people teaching in classrooms and students, either middle school or high school or collegiate, There are always privacy issues, and particularly if we are doing work in looking at our own practice in the classroom and making that available to our colleagues, it's a really risky situation. So having those conversations upfront about data sharing are super, super important. I have some ideas about what I think some areas of critical need are right now, but I want to start this conversation with all of you. So if you think about a research practice partnership, you know, some problem of practice that you're interested in bringing a research lens to, whether it's you doing the work or not, what aspects of the work that you do you think would benefit from kind of the examination, the engagement of a research practice partnership? So go ahead and type an answer in the chat or unmute your mic and share something. I'll give you about the next 71 seconds to share a thought about this.
I guess I'll jump in if no one else will. I'm Eric Newman. I teach at a large urban community college. And our city's school district is very top down and very sort of hard to navigate within its internal politics. And any research idea I might have and any collaboration we've tried to have at the teacher-to-teacher level, it just seems to not be able to get anywhere until the big people somehow get on board and they don't have time for us. So even before I can think of what I'd want to research, do you have any advice on how to actually get those connections, to get people the resources to have these conversations? I know a separate challenge is a lot of our students, our remedial classes is the first time they've ever been able to get an F. And so when I talk to the high school teachers, they're really trying to teach their content, but their students need the remediation that we provide in our arithmetic class, but they're not allowed to teach arithmetic because the course says algebra 2. And so the students just kind of sit there dazed the whole year. So how do we do research with them if they can't actually teach what the students need to learn? Please help.
That's quite a complex set of questions there. So I think in terms of getting access, as someone who's worked with a number of large urban school districts, there isn't a single one that hasn't been challenging to get access to. And I don't want people to take that as a knock on large urban school districts. Those barriers are there for very, very good reasons in terms of making sure that if they're going to give access to students, particularly as maligned as large urban school districts tend to be, I think they're cautious about just letting anyone in the door to engage with the teachers to do some research. My best line of attack on that has been actually just to, before I even have even a really solidified idea, to start to do some relationship building with a large urban school district's research office. And large urban school districts also tend to have a lot of turnover in central office. So sometimes, you know, the outreach I've done to a research office 6 months ago is going to have to roll back and start from scratch because turnover has happened there and I've got a new face that I need to introduce to my work and start thinking about that. The other thing that I think has been particularly helpful in approaching a large urban school district when I've had a big research project that I wanted to do is to go in and start by listening, is to start by saying, tell me a little bit about what you see the needs are. I think those large districts sometimes can be a little bit wary of somebody rolling in and saying, hey, I've got this great idea. You know, I've seen all these problems from the students who come to us at the university level, and I've got this great idea for how we can solve all of our problems in this. And they're like, well, whoa, we've got a different set of priorities than you have. And that's always true. So starting by listening, building those relationships, with the research office, and think about building those relationships at different levels, like with the research office, with the teachers in those schools, with the administrators in those schools is really, really helpful. So that's my best kind of set of recommendations around that. And it sounds like that set of ideas of like, how do we do this work, let's say in an Algebra 2 class, of teaching grade level content and supporting kids and building skills that we may have hoped that they came to us with, but they haven't. That's a great, I would love to do research practice partnership around that. Some other things I see highlighted in the chat, and I won't be able to narrate maybe everything in here. And thank you for all these contributions. They're wonderful. Like thinking about how a 2-year college mathematics invites or excludes students on the STEM pathway. Oh goodness, I love that. How do we get students to reflect, to self-analyze? Co-requisite models. I see Kate Jackie talking about developmental mathematics and what pathways work best. Shout out to my recently anointed former doctoral student, Leah Reineck, who did a fabulous dissertation looking at UWM's developmental mathematics and what we can do with that. So I see a lot of that work. I agree with this issue about kind of shrinking years of mathematics education into that basic education, developmental education, and also acknowledging that that's different work, that people are coming into that with existing knowledge. So it's a little bit different from the way I thought about teaching middle school and high school math when I was doing that this is content that most of them hadn't seen before. Thinking about the impact of class size on student success, like that, and that becomes even more important as we see our budgets being constrained. So here are some of the things that I wrote down. Some of these resonate with the ideas that you've put in there. And some of these might be slightly new. So think about this idea of curricular overlap between secondary and early college mathematics. Like, how do we think about and study where our overlap is? What's a productive level of overlap? What's an unproductive level of overlap? Think about what's the efficacy of research-based pedagogical practices in early college mathematics. So thinking about like NCTM's 8 effective mathematics teaching practices, or other practice-based framework, like the 5 practices work that I know Keith has done a ton with in his own context. Think about number talks that I know Leah Reineck has, and I know a number of other people have taken up number talks, and think about how those translate into developmental mathematics and kind of early college mathematics. What really is the mathematics that's needed for majors and careers in alignment with course content? There's some cases we haven't visited that question in our institutions in 20 to 30 years. So we're dealing with these, we go back to that old, like, gotta have college algebra. Is that really where we need to be? And then of course, developmental mathematics that I see people talking about robustly in the chat. So let me share a little bit about some snapshots of a couple of research practice partnerships that I think are particularly interesting. The first one, we call it the M-Cube partnership in Milwaukee. This is one that I have a little bit more personal stake in and fluency. So this one's near and dear to my heart. The second one is one that I just know from the outside, from work and talk and writing that's gone into that. So I'll share a little bit about each of these. So M-Cubed, which recognizes those 3 levels that we're working in Milwaukee, our high school, our middle school and high school, and our 2-year and our 4-year institutions in the city. The vision of this project really was to create a coherent public education network that really allowed the strengthening of our communities as we turn students out from whatever pathways they're coming through. So this M-Cube is not specific to mathematics, although there's a huge math component that we have to this work, but really making it easier for students to transition across those 3 institutions, since that really is the bread and butter of where our students are coming from in Milwaukee. So here, I won't read word for word what you've got on here, but here are the stated goals of the project. You can see this is a research practice partnership that is ambitious. Just like I can even unpack like item three into so many different aspects that you could look at and you could study in there. And that's just one of the five goals that they articulate there. And three is the one that I'll highlight a little bit more about, because that's really where a lot of our mathematics efforts have gone. So in thinking about this idea,
Mike, I want to give you about 5 minutes. So just letting you know, especially if you want to leave time for more questions.
Perfect. So we've really focused on this curriculum articulation of some cross-level professional development around key mathematical ideas like high cognitive demand tasks and productive struggle, and fostering and strengthening those pathways with targets of increasing our success rate and our ability for students to place right straight into credit-bearing mathematics at these levels. You see kind of where we've roughed out those targets. And some of the outcomes that we've had so far that I think have been really interesting. We are in the process now of completely realigning the high school college mathematics pathways. We've been putting our quantitative reasoning course that we have now in as a fourth year course in Milwaukee Public Schools, moving it from the collegiate level to high school to really make that a meaningful experience. We've really pushed to de-emphasize the college algebra pathway as the primary credit bearing course. It's still there, but really shifting that to quantitative reasoning and having everybody on the same page about how we talk about what real meaningful sense making and learning looks like in mathematics, really focusing on that meaningful problem solving and productive struggle. Then the second case that I want to talk about briefly at Eastern Washington University is what they've referred to as the Successful Transitions to College Project. So you're going to see some similarities here. They have a number of inquiries that they've looked at in the context of mathematics. So some of them related to classroom environment, some of them related to more how we transfer knowledge from one place to another. Culture of student independence, I think, is really interesting. One of the things I found neat about this research of practice partnership is the early work they did in finding common ground to define the problems that they worked on. The third bullet here, I think, was the most innovative one to me, is that they started by observing one another's teaching across levels. So they had high school teachers going into the four-year college classrooms and two-year college teachers going into the high school classrooms and observing one another with a collaboratively designed observation protocol that was based on their shared values that they determined. And then this allowed them to forge a path forward towards intervention, towards data collection, and towards identifying and answering some of those questions. So let me give you a couple of calls to action here to make. So here's some things that I think you can do. Meeting informally with colleagues across these levels, discussing those shared challenges. You're here at AMATIC, you're doing that right now. Making use of your local and state professional associations. Our regional and local affiliates are great places to get these conversations started because you've got professionally engaged folks who are working in those local contexts. And then thinking about how we use our professional standards, documents, and guidelines as a grounding point for these inquiries. I promised to talk about funding, and here it is. The Spencer Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the NSF, we all fund research practice partnerships at various different scales. So you can look for some funding internally to do this, but looking outside, it's way easier to do than you might think if you haven't done it before. I'm always happy to talk about this. And then thinking about what's a modest project that we can tackle that then might have implications that would scale. We're not going to change the world all at once, so don't feel like you have to. And make sure as you're going about putting these partnerships together that you're sharing that work back into our professional communities. So let me stop there and hear what you're wondering about. So pop open a mic, type something in the chat. What questions can we answer? Wait time's so weird in the pandemic. Anybody notice that? You're waiting for people to type, like it takes a minute.
I mean, we have older questions from before, but.
Fire away.
So as I'm looking at this, some of the older questions that I see is, this is, I think, regarding to your earlier topic. And I apologize if I have not got everything. Also, I'm sure people are interested in your contact information if they want to have an offline conversation with you. But should word problems be in developmental mathematics be heavily based on real life situations, or should there be more emphasis in the STEM fields?
That's a good question. And I think that'd be a great one for a research practice partnership to tackle. But I think understanding what's the mathematics that our students are making use of and thinking about in their lives, in their context, is always the place I go. We can always make those specialized connections to the fields that they're going towards. But because we're the ones that often write the curriculum, write the problems, we gravitate towards those STEM questions. And I think being aware and cognizant of that and being in touch with what our kids are bringing together, what the mathematics is that they're seeing in their worlds is critically important, particularly at this moment. So listening and observing, I see Anne talking about. So how do we do this with all the biases that exist? I think that's really the importance of bringing these groups together. One of the things that the Eastern Washington information showed is there was a lot of this finger pointing early on saying, oh, yeah, we're at the two-year college and we're getting these students who just aren't prepared. What the heck are they doing down there in high school? And then when they went down to see what's going on in high school, it changed people's views and changed their opinion. And similarly, as the high school teachers went into the university level and saying, oh, well, we've got to prepare them to be able to take notes and they're just going to get lectured at for 60 minutes three times a week. And we know that's not the way we're trying to teach mathematics at the collegiate level. And most of us aren't just talking at kids for 60 minutes three times a week. So that really opened the high school teacher's eyes to what was going on. So really developing those shared understandings is really critically important. Debbie is sharing that she was part of that group 20 years ago in Washington, and the change has been fantastic. But yes, it has to be maintained, and keeping the momentum of a research practice partnership is a real challenge. Thinking about how you sustain it, how you foster leadership within it.
So can we thank Mike for a great talk? Everybody can use their reactions to applaud or say thank you in the box. And we will move on to the next hour.
Thank you all. I very much appreciate you spending some time and always appreciate the opportunity to talk with my enigmatic colleagues. If there's stuff you'd like to follow up with, shoot me an email, steelm@uwm.edu. I'm easy to find. I'm not the former RNC chair. That's the only thing I'll do. As long as you don't send an email to him, you're good.
Thank you so much, Mike. And it's wonderful to have you part of our presidential exchange. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
See y'all at the next session.